I am very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Reverend James Ninru. He is from South Sudan. He is a human rights activist working with environmental and extractive issues. He's the liaison officer for the Presbyterian Church of South Sudan in the capital of the country, Juba. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you will be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the First Presbyterian Church here in Santa Fe on Grant Avenue. Now, I think a lot of people have been following to a greater or lesser extent what's been happening all of these years in Sudan and South Sudan. South Sudan is a relatively new country. It's only, what, 3 or 4 years old?
3 years old.
And it's a country of 8 million people. What is it like there since it became an independent country?
Well, since we became an independent country, South Sudan, 3 years ago, that is in 2011, hope were very high for the Southern Sudanese because we have been in war for the last 50 years, and it was a golden chance that we got our independence. So people were hoping that peace would have come and development would have been initiated. A school would be open, road network would be initiated, and yes, fairly a lot of these developmental things happen, and people were happy, and we made a big push, but unfortunately after that we slide back because of some few problems with the leadership and with the party that is leading the country.
And so what happened then?
It is like the ruling party, which is called SPLM, the Sudan People Liberation Movement, got into disagreement among themselves. The current president, who is Salva Kiir Mayardit, his term coming into an end next year by April. His colleagues in the parties, that is Dr. Riek Machar, Rebecca Nyandeng, Mukwior, and the rest, asked him not to consider standing for next year presidential election. And he's upset, he doesn't want that idea, and he's accusing this group of trying to stage a coup and trying to sabotage his work. So he tried to arrest them, and that arrest has been resisted. And in the events of resistance, it ended up that firearm was exchanged, and then those of Riek Machar who were asking for him to step down had to run for their life, and then those he managed to capture were put in jail and detained. So that's what happened.
After all of those years of war, it must be difficult to have not only a politics of peace, but a culture of peace and a mindset of peace.
Yes, it's really difficult, and people were upset. The churches, the civil society, and the community, we are hoping that they could find another way of resolving this problem. Because being in war for those number of years, the culture that is inculcated in the mind of the people is to resolve things through the barrel of the guns. We have not learned how to resolve things peacefully and through dialogue. Right now, the two parties have been called to Addis Ababa to sit down and resolve this issue peacefully. And they are, right now as we speak, they are doing that.
What is your role then as a peacemaker, as a minister in the church, as an activist?
Well, as a church, the church is trying its level best and trying to reconcile people. And since we are not able to reconcile this leadership, who is on the top leader, now what we have resulted into talking to the grassroots, the youth, the community, What we are asking them is that they should not be used by politicians. They should not be supporting them. So we are trying to discourage them from supporting either side, because that would only increase the death, the rate of the death of the people. And our youth, because of lack of jobs, some of them, the only career that they have is to hold gun. So it's very difficult to convince some of them, but we are trying that. And we are also represented in Addis Ababa talk, where the two warring parties has been called to talk. Church is represented, the civil society is represented. I'm connected also to other civil society that are calling and calling for peace. And what we are advocating for is that there should be an interim arrangement for the country, so that we minimize death and we bring the two together. And then this interim arrangement should be led, our opinion is that it should not be led by either of the two fighting groups. We should look for a South Sudanese who is neutral, who is respected everywhere, and then that should be the person to lead that interim administration for a certain period, maybe 3 years, and after that it will be tasked to reconcile people, to resettle the displaced that have gone and the refugees, to work on the constitution, to work on election laws, because after that period there would be a fresh election whereby we would have a new leader that has come through the people.
Is there such a person who is ready to lead the South Sudanese people, who's not a member of the two fighting parties?
I think we have other parties which did not got a chance to lead the country, so we can find a person. We have members of civil society who have not who have no side, could be. We could pick from any those old administrators that have been working in the government for a long time, and retired people who could really respect and honor the South Sudanese by leading them in that period. So if a surge is declared, we will find someone.
So I've been reading about Sudan a little bit, Sudan and South Sudan, and it seems that when the two countries, I mean, it was one very large country split in two, the north is Islamic, the south is many different religions and ethnicities and languages. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. In the south, 90% of the southerners are Christians. And we have 10% that would include Muslim, would include animist, and include other people who have their traditional beliefs. Yeah. And in the north, 90%, which is the Sudan now, 90% are Muslims, and maybe 10% Christians.
And so is there at this point a sense of South Sudanese identity and culture?
Well, there is a sense of identity and culture that is an Africanism, being Africans and being Christians. These are two uniting factors. Although the politicians would use their ethnicities to back them up in terms of getting more votes, in terms of influencing policies, and that's what happened and made this war to be seen like it is an ethnic motivated war.
So the politicians would like to sell it, the current conflict, as an ethnic conflict when it's actually two warring parties.
Yes, they wanted to look at an ethnic conflict when it is already a political conflict.
Right.
Because originally it is one party that breaks into two. So there shouldn't be an ethnic element in it. But because they looking for support, they are doing it that way.
What is the significance of oil? Oil was discovered some time ago in Sudan when it was one big country, and it does play a very significant economic role and I think also human rights role.
Yeah, oil is seemed to be fueling the war because the revenue that comes from oil, instead of it being used to develop for development and being used to render services to the community, part of it is being used now to buy weaponry. And China is in front line. They are the one developing the oil, and they are the one also selling guns into South Sudan. In terms of human rights, yes, oil company has been playing a major role in polluting the environment. And as a result, we in the church and the human rights, we took it upon ourselves to confront those companies. And we confronted in the past a Canadian company called Talisman, and we filed a suit against them. And that forced them to withdraw and sell their shares. Another company from Sweden bought that company and also did not change the practice. So we also ran after that company, and that company also withdrew, although they are still in the country, in another form by having shares in some other companies. So those cases, the one of Talisman did not go very far because they had to leave the country and they had to sell their shares. But the current company, which is Lundin, we are still after that company, and we launched a report detailing the damage that they have done and the displacement of the people. And we went to Sweden, and now the Swedish government has taken it and they are investigating this company. It may end up as a case, or whatever they would find, they will let us know.
When you bring a lawsuit of that kind, what is the court in which you are bringing it? Is it in South Sudan? Is it in Sweden or Canada or wherever the country is?
Well, the first lawsuit was here in the United States as a class action. It was here in the United States, but it could not go far. The current one now, it is the Swedish government taking it up, and they will be providing a lawyer to the plaintiffs, of which I'm one of them. Right now they are doing investigation. They have sent team to South Sudan to investigate, and they are still trying to find witness, trying to dig into the matter before they could declare whether it is a case to be followed.
What does the environmental damage look like that's been brought about by the oil companies?
Well, there are so many of them. One of them is when they are working there, a lot of is spilled in the water, and our place is a set where there's plenty of water. And again, they are using in their drilling, they inject chemicals and water for them to bring up the oil. And this used chemical, they are left in open, and our cattle, our animals are dying out of that, and even people.
It seems like, I mean, we have similar situations here with hydraulic fracturing. We have similar situations in South America. We have them all over the world. Wherever there's oil, oil seems to be almost more a curse than a blessing for countries where it's found. Are there practices that could be used that you are asking them to do for drilling in a way that you can still drill for oil but not harm the environment?
Well, they would be the one to know better. But when I went to Sweden, this same company, they are having drilling in Sweden. But not the same practice that they are doing in South Sudan, they are doing in Sweden. They have been contracted by the Norwegian government also to drill in the sea, and they are not doing the same practice.
Right.
So why do you have two scale for the same thing?
Right, it valuing people differently.
Yeah.
Norway did such an interesting thing. They discovered oil in the ocean, and instead of taking it all out at once, they decided to take it out slowly over many years so that they wouldn't have the incredible oil boom followed by an economic bust.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like only the Norwegians are capable of doing that, but it was an interesting idea.
Yeah, the Norwegians are helping our government now, we're trying to copy some of the example, and we are trying to convince the companies also to go the Norwegian way.
To drill more slow, less per year.
Yes, but it's not possible now because this agreement were done when we were still in war. The current government of Southern Sudan have no big hands because they cannot change the contract. The contract was done when Khartoum government was the government, so we are still facing it rough, but we are trying our best.
So you have to wait, in theory, till the expiration of the contract?
I think we are negotiating. I don't know what will happen.
Yeah. Very interesting. We're talking to Reverend James Ninru about South Sudan. He is from the capital of South Sudan. Now, did you grow up Presbyterian?
I can say I grew up Presbyterian, but my family, my father and mother, were not originally even Christians.
What were they?
They were just have their traditional beliefs. So when I went to school is when I got converted and became interested in the subject, and I was introduced to the local priest. Then I went through catechism classes. Then I was baptized. So I became a Christian. Since then, I became following Christ, and I was happy up to now that I have taken that choice. My parents also were happy. They were not pressurizing me. They left me free. Yeah.
Are there examples of traditional religions and Christianity kind of mixing? So the practices for example, somebody's parents coming into a practice of Christianity in South Sudan, where you are?
No, because we have the Bible as our guide, and so we know where we should not mix these things, and that is clear cut. But that does not turn us to enemies.
Right. So, do you, for example, Christians and non-Christian people, do you work together as activists and for peace?
Yeah, of course there are things that bring people together, like lack of fish now is everybody concerned. Whether you are a Christian, you are a Muslim, you are an animist, all of us are concerned, and it is in the best of our interest that we should work together. So there is no contradiction in that.
What is your vision for how South Sudan could be in terms of government, human rights, economy, things like that? I mean, it's a poor country right now, and a country with a lot of problems, not only the history of conflict, but health issues, infant mortality, poverty, things that everybody talks about, they become words. But what is your vision for what it could look like maybe in one or two generations?
Well, I cannot classify South Sudan as poor in terms of resources. But it's poor in terms of governance, in terms of management of those resources. But otherwise, we are very rich. We are very good land, fertile, which is enough to be a breadbasket for the region. We have minerals, gold, and the rest. We have oil. We have water, abundant fish, abundant wildlife. And so it's a matter of management and governance issues that making that country to be looked as poor. My vision is to see South Sudan a democratic country that respect everybody regardless of where they come from and the language in the region they are coming from. A country that have principle of governance and development and respect of human rights. And if we go that way, not 20 years, in the next 10 years we will be a different country.
What is your relationship like with your neighbors?
Our neighbors like Sudan, and we have so many neighbors, but we don't have any actual problems since then. Maybe occasionally sometime we have an issue with Sudan because the infrastructure for the oil is passing through Sudan since
right.
We are a landlocked country. So the infrastructure, like the pipeline, is going to through Sudan to Port Sudan. And in the past, we had very bad experience with them, and then we are trying to manage that. We are trying to learn, and they are trying to learn that we need each other. Because through that facility, South Sudan is paying a lot of money, which is also helping in the development of the north. So the northerners are not ready to lose that. Also, we are not ready to block the way for us to ferry our oil to the market, to the world market. So we are learning how to cooperate and how to come together.
What is daily life like in the capital, in Juba? What are people doing? What is the scene of, for example, arts and music and sports and things like that?
Well, before this incident of September 2013, Juba was very busy. Children going to school, everybody going to his work, and you'll find everybody's busy because since we got our independence, everybody's wanted to establish himself, wanted to build something, wanted to settle, and you will find everybody's busy. But also our politicians were busy. In corruption, in issues that are not helping. As a result, we were not able to achieve much as expected during that period. Otherwise, and after the incident now, everybody is fearing. Most of the people have run out of the country, and even investors that came to help, because now they are seeing it, there's no future, they have run out, and we become like, the government is busy trying to convince people to come back, but for sure that will not help unless they see a signed peace agreement that will help people.
Do you have an active media? Is there freedom of the press? Are there issues of censorship, things like that?
We have government radios, we have some private radios, but they are not working freely. As I was coming here, one of the church radio was, the interviewer were taken by the security because they have interviewed some people who consider to be rebels, and they aired that in the capital Juba, so they were taken by the security. So there's no freedom of expression, and we have some newspapers, but still the reporters are facing the same.
What is your hope in the United States? I mean, you're touring to various, I guess, mostly Presbyterian churches, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
So what do you hope to accomplish by educating people here about South Sudan?
Well, the church is a very powerful institution, whether here in the United States or back home. And from the last experience that we had, we got our independence because churches in the West, and especially in the United States, took it upon themselves to inform the public in the United States about what is happening, including the politicians. And we in South Sudan, we really respect the former president, Bush, that he took it upon himself. And Bush was also counting on the backup of the churches. And by coming here and by convincing our partner, which is the Church of Presbyterian Church here, we know the church will reach out and our voice will be amplified and our story will be heard through them, even though we are not here 24 hours. But we trust that the churches here are in solidarity with the churches and with the people of South Sudan. And it's not only the Presbyterian Church. We know the Anglican Church and Episcopal Church and the Catholic Church. All the churches here are working together. But since it is the Presbyterian who invited us and who invited me, and that is why I'm going to the Presbyterian churches. But otherwise, I have no problem going to any other churches apart from the Presbyterian.
Is it safe for outsiders to visit South Sudan? Probably not so much. Do you have visitors from other countries? I know you have refugees.
Yeah, it's not that safe too much, but there are some people who have taken upon themselves also to be there. Like now, we have 5 missionaries from the Presbyterian who are working with us. We try to convince them to go home and come back later, but some of them say no. We are together in this, and we are happy to see that.
Tell us about the food situation. Has there been famine? I know that there are issues having to do with drought and farming and things like that.
Well, we have only 2 seasons in South Sudan. That is a dry season and a wet season. In the wet season, this is the season where people cultivate and work on their farms. But since this incident in December last year, we have now about 4.5 million displaced persons, internally displaced persons. And this internally displaced person, meaning that they are out of their normal place. They have gone to the wilderness. Some have crossed to other countries. So their normal routine is disturbed, so they are not there. That means they have already missed the season, because right now we are in the rainy season and it's finishing in October next month. So they have already missed the rainy season, which means that they have not cultivated. So we are not expecting any harvest next year. So there's looming hunger, and which is going to happen. And already agencies like World Food Program and UN agencies are reporting on that. In Darfur, the issue is quite different. Darfur is a desert, and they don't have this opportunity of cultivation. They are buying food and depending on the food that... But because they are also facing problem, they are at the run, and some of them are refugees, so there's no food there. There's a need for the people in Darfur. The same in Nuba Mountains, the same in Angasana, people would be dying.
Is there aid coming in from the outside?
Well, right now there are some work being done to deliver it. But the same poor road network And because it is rainy seasons, mainly the World Food Program and other agencies are depending on airdrops. And taking food by air, you can only take that much, which would not be enough for anybody. And you can only drop cereals. Other food items you cannot drop. You cannot drop oil. You cannot drop the rest of the thing. So that is also another challenge.
In places where there's a rainy season and a dry season, during the dry season, water is a big issue. Are there any technologies that would help people in South Sudan during the dry season? I don't know, irrigation or well technologies, things like that?
No, that technology is not available now. And that would be one of the policies the government would have encouraged people if they were to be in a peaceful situation. And some of the NGOs has already tried to advocate for that and try to make people learn and train them on how to use ox plow, for example, and how to use irrigation to supplement feeding, and how to use agriculture, things like that. But now, since there's displacement and people are in the run, it is not possible.
You have 7 children. Tell us a little bit about what they're like and what their hopes are for their country, what their interests are.
Well, I'm a married man. I have family and I have 7 children. 3 of them are boys. The older one is 31 years. He just got married last month.
Ah.
The youngest one is turning 15 next January. I have 4 girls. Of course, myself, I have been in the war for the last how many years? I don't know. Since I was born, the war has been off and on. And as a result, we have been moving also from place to place. So when finally we came home and the peace agreement was signed, it's like everybody was happy and we were trying to settle and plan for the future. So these children, their education has been interrupted several times. Right now they are not living in South Sudan because we had to move when everybody was running out of the country. They are living in Nairobi. And myself, I'm back in South Sudan because I want to participate and see how peace could be brought. And occasionally I go to them and visit them. Only 2 now are in school. The rest are not schooling. Some of them have finished what they are doing. So they are just waiting for the opportunity when peace comes, so one could embark in something that beneficial to him and to the family.
Are there a lot of, for example, your colleagues who have children who are abroad right now? Are there lots of people who you think would like to come back to South Sudan and build the country?
Well, when South Sudan got its independence, many people came to South Sudan from different part of the world, from United States, those who went, the lost boy made it home, and the rest. But after that, now one has to think twice whether you will go to South Sudan now or not. But we are hopeful. The minute they will sign an agreement that we think is going to bring peace, I think everybody also would come back to South Sudan, because all of us love South Sudan and we want to do something and we want to settle. We want to be in a place that call home, because for a long time we have been not in our home. We have been just wandering around. So it would be a very good opportunity for people to settle.
And of course, stability is what people want more than anything else.
Exactly.
Anywhere peace, in the world.
Peace is what brings people together. Yeah.
What is the role of women in South Sudan? In other words, Are there any women in government? Do boys and girls get educated equally, or if there is peace, is that the idea that, that there will be equality in education?
Well, in terms of involvement of women in the government, there are few women that are in the government. And since the independence, there was an affirmative action of giving the women 25%. Although it has not been implemented fully, but we still see women activists, women leaders being represented in the government. In terms of education, yes, we are campaigning and we are encouraging that both girls shall and boys shall should go to school. And it has been going on well, especially in urban areas. In the villages and outside the urban areas, it is difficult, not because people do not want their girls to go to school, but sometimes the school may be a distant, and sometimes one would fear that if you send your girl child to the school and come very late, then safety issues would become. Also, there is lack of teachers, and that also has been a problem. But UN agencies and Ministry of Education are working together to find a formula of how best a girl child could be given priority for education.
Mm-hmm. Reverend James Ninru is a human rights activist in South Sudan. He's from the capital, Juba. He will be at the First Presbyterian Church on Grant Avenue tonight at 7 o'clock in the evening, so people can come and see you and ask questions.
Please, they're welcome.
It's great to have you on the Radio Cafe. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah. Thank you.